welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. My guest today is Joy Behar, who's back for part two of our interview. Now, she's an Emmy Award-winning TV host, a stand-up comedian, an actress, an author, a playwright. So let's get right to her now. Joy, a little earlier today, you mentioned about your dad, and you said that he was a gambler. And yeah. I'm wondering, did that affect your feeling about money? It must have been a little insecure kind of growing up.
Well, yeah. I mean, we never had a car. We didn't own a house. None of that. We didn't have any of that. We lived in a tenement on the fifth floor. And we could have had much better because he had made a good living and my mother also worked, but it just went all down the drain. So, but I was the good part about it was that in the building that I grew up in, my aunts and uncles were on the third floor and I was on the fifth. So I had a lot of love and affection and attention paid to me.
My interest was knowing, because we're all affected tremendously by our childhood, yes. What about money? In other words, was money something you were quite nervous about as a young woman?
Yes, I was, and I'm always very careful about money. I'm not a spendthrift. I don't go around buying 10 pairs of, Gucci shoes and all that stuff. I don't do that. But the thing that I think I did inherit from him is I had a little bit of a gambling streak myself.
Oh.
But in a certain way, because I've had a lot of therapy, it's controlled. So, we'll go to Atlantic City, and I'll play blackjack, and I'll maybe lose $300, and that's it. And then I start to be annoyed that I lost $300, so I'll stop. But I've taken risks with my career because of the gambling gene also a little bit. So it's called the gambling gene plus therapy, and you can handle it.
Well, but one of the things that you established was that you had that kind of net of the family. And with that net, you can take risks, I think. I think when you know, you don't you think?
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. If you know what, go ahead. You were finishing.
No, I was going to say that's a big, easier. I mean, I was an only child, and I also had great love from my parents. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of things that now, in retrospect, I never would do. Because I've learned, I told the boss of a job, if you don't give me this promotion, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I'd never do that. I had a great job. And he said, you understand if I give you this job and you don't do it, I'm firing you. But I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I'd never do that now. Never in a million years.
Oh.
But then I could do it. Anyhow.
Yeah.
Enough about me.
It's not just that you had a loving family. It's that you believe in your own talent. I mean, because I've walked out on things also because I was like, okay, I'll get another one.
Right. That's right. But you have to have, I think, that security from what they gave you.
It helps.
You know, I think that really is a big help. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
I mean, what is childhood besides it's a rehearsal for adulthood.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And sometimes not even a dress rehearsal.
No.
I wanted to ask you, if I could, about Good Morning America, because we mentioned earlier that you were a receptionist, but you also became a producer, and then on top of that, you were fired. So let's go along each way. As the receptionist, were you telling jokes at people? What were you doing besides answering the phone?
I was doing shtick. I was doing shtick all day. The producer, people would hang around my desk. And we had something called lesbian hour in the afternoon. And all the women would gather around my desk and we just howled for about an hour. Once we would let one guy was allowed, George Merlis, who was the executive producer, he was allowed to come. And he was a fun guy. So, you know what? I was holding court, a lot of it. But I wasn't really doing the job exactly. And then they decided to, my boss, Tori Baker, she is a lovely person. She promoted me to be a research/producer. And I had to set up field project. The field producer would have to go to like Kalamazoo or someplace and do a film of something going on there, let's say. All right. So my job was to set the shoot up. what time, where, who would be there, what the telephone numbers, all that stuff, and call people and say, this is what's going to happen. So
did you go? Did you go yourself?
No, I stayed in the office. It was not, that was not part of the job. So one day, they were, the animals from Barnum and Bailey were coming through the Midtown Tunnel. That's how they would come in to do the circus. And it's at midnight. So 12 a.m., animals are coming through this, the tunnel. I have to set that up. And instead of putting 12 a.m., I put 12 p.m.
Oh.
So, and I thought I had done such a brilliant job. The next morning, I'm in my apartment. I'm a little bit late for work because I figured I did the whole thing. It was brilliant. And so the executive producer, not the, the one I mentioned, another one, a woman, calls me and says, why aren't you in the office? And I said, I'm a little sick this morning. I don't know. And then she said, do you realize what you did? And I said, what? She said, you said that the animals were coming in the afternoon, not the middle of the night. And then I said, oh, this is the end for me. And very shortly thereafter, I was out of there.
that was your exit. I'll tell you a quick story.
I can't say that it was that alone. They also realized I was doing, you know, I was doing stand-up on the weekends. I really wasn't into the job.
No. I tell you a quick story. For years and years, they marched the elephants down 7th Avenue and made a right turn to go to Madison Square Garden at 50th and 8th. Well, the following year, one year, when they marched them down, they started to make the right, and the trainers started hitting them because they had moved the garden down to the 30s. As you know, it was no longer there. The elephants refused. They kept going. They went to 8th Avenue, and finally, when they realized it was rubble, there was no Madison Square Garden, they became docile, went back to 7th, went down. But that's a great story.
But that an elephant never forgets what? An elephant never forgets even a location.
That's apparently. Apparently.
Animals are unbelievable.
Anyhow, so at this time, you're also working Catch a Rising Star, I assume, yes, right?
Yeah. And the I was at a club in the Village called Comedy U, like at Comedy University.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, so yeah. I was all over the city.
Yeah, the reason I mentioned Catch a Rising Star was that if there ever was a good title, I mean, Robin Williams, Jerry Seinfeld, I mean, so many of the people that really huge were there to, I guess, fail a bit and work their material, right?
Really, in those days, there was no internet. There was no internet. There was no YouTube. There was no nothing. So you, in order for you to be seen by agents and people who would hire you, they had to actually physically go to the club. So you really couldn't fail in those clubs. And it was hard for. I mean, I had to follow Rodney Dangerfield, Robin Williams. To follow Robin Williams is a nightmare. Not only is he brilliant and funny, but the guy has high energy. And so if you're coming on with a, you know, your normal person, me, dressed like a person, woman, just who are you and why are you here, you know?
Yeah. And also, I think Eddie Murphy, too. I didn't mention him. I think he was there as well.
One time, yeah.
Yeah, that's tough. Well, is it true that there was a sign at Catch a Rising Star that said all entertainers must leave the stage instantly if any objects are thrown?
I never saw that. Who told you that?
My research on the internet tells me that's what was said.
I never saw that, so I don't know. But witnesses were polite. They didn't really heckle very much. They were good audience.
Yeah,
they had cover charge. They didn't want to get thrown out either.
No. Well, thinking of the objects, the only time I get political is 1 second when I remember George Bush as president had a boot thrown at him. You know, that's the only object I know. But that's, we're not going to go there, that's for sure.
You can mention that because I thought that that was very graceful of him, the way he handled it, to tell you the truth. He didn't
dodged.
Like, what are you doing? You know, other presidents who shall be nameless, that would have been retribution time on a high scale. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Well, you had said to me that times on The View could be tough and other times great. What did the environment change depending on who the people were on the panel? I would assume, right?
Of course.
And why would was the toxic, if it was toxic, was that about the idea of the red and the blue states, the idea of not being able to handle each other's?
Well, during the Bush administration, I think after they invaded Iraq, I believe, or after that period of, in history, it got more political. And then we would have arguments, Democrats and Republicans, et cetera. And that seems to have continued. And now we're in this situation. So it's become more and more political since 9/11, I guess.
How are the topics chosen? How is that?
Every morning we get a list of like 30 topics or more from researchers. And we have to pick, each one of us gets the list. So there's five of us, sometimes six. And when Anna Navarro comes on, and we each pick what we think is the top story to talk about. And then we always have a lighter story, too. So we choose it, and then there's a meeting, and then it's decided what we're going to talk about. And it seems like the audience wants to hear from us about what's going on that day.
Right. Now, you had said on an interview with somebody, so I know this is true because I saw it was you, that the Weekend View is a much looser, and I think you might have enjoyed it more. Why is that, Joy?
We don't talk politics on the Weekend View. The Weekend View is all about relationships. We pick up stories from the Housewives, you know, the Andy Cohen franchise, because they're always coming up with some mishigas, you know. and so they're a little bit less contentious. And they're fun. I like to talk about psychological stories. I like to talk about relationships. My play, My First Ex-Husband, is all about relationships. That's what I write about. Even another one that I wrote, Bonkers in the Burrows, which is going to be in Bay Street Theater in the summer, is about people's family relationships. They're not political.
And that's actually the closest to your heart, I gather.
Totally. Well, I was always political from even when I was in college. I marched against the Vietnam War and I, you know, a lot of that, but I'm a comedian at heart and I like to have fun when I talk and make it interesting and funny and fun. And politics these days is not that funny.
No, I'd say, especially these days. Yeah. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about substituting for Larry King. I think you did that for a while, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, they would ask me to sit in and do that. I liked that. I liked doing that. Yeah. They had producers over there, and they would give me a lot of questions to ask. And then you had a one-on-one. And I'm a pretty good interviewer. I like to listen and follow up. And so I liked that job. But they gave it to somebody else when he left.
Did you get to know him at all?
Well, he interviewed me a couple of times, too. He was nice.
Right. Lovely. Yeah. And were there restrictions at all? They gave you questions, but were there restrictions or none?
No. It was live also, right?
Right.
I don't remember anyone telling me anything about what to say, what not to say. No.
Yeah. Well, you've had a whole, besides The View, you've had a bunch of television shows.
I have.
And some of them were ironically successful, and yet you were taken off.
I had a show on HLN, which is owned by CNN. It's a headline news network.
Yes.
And at the time, they were looking for a show like mine, like I could provide. And so I got the job, and I was there for at least 2 years, maybe three, I don't remember.
You were, and you were the second highest rated show they had.
We were the second highest, and I would do The View, and then in the afternoon I did the HLN show. And they canceled the show because I think they were moving it over to more crime. Nancy Grace was doing more crime, and I think that was the show that they wanted to put in there. And they didn't, and I didn't feel like doing that. I didn't want to do Casey Anthony, who was the crime story of the day. I was really, so again, I said no. And that was the end of it. Then I got another show on what they current TV, which was owned by Al Gore and some other guy, I forget his name. And then they, after a couple of years of that, they sold that network to Al Jazeera. And then that was the end of my show. But you know what they say, Julian? The show must go off.
That's why we're here, Joy. Anyhow, it is a kind of a strange time to be doing the View, in as much as whatever you introduce, half the panel will be against, half the country's against. It's a time that I didn't expect we would see. But are you able to use any of that in your comedy that you do?
I don't do stand up anymore.
No, I meant the plays.
Oh, in my plays?
Yeah.
Maybe. Not. I don't directly put politics into my plays at the moment.
You did tell me that you were doing something in March, and that I want to talk about. What were you doing?
I'm doing the same show in March in Boston.
Oh, good. Let's talk about that then.
All right. I wish I knew the theater. Oh, the Huntington Theater. That's where it is.
Okay. And what show is it? Which one?
It's called My First Ex-Husband. And I'm doing that in March. Yeah, I'll give you the dates. So, but what was I saying about that?
I asked you about it because I knew that will make sense for our show.
Okay, but it's the 27th, 28th, and 29th of March.
Oh, okay.
At the Huntington Theater.
I want to talk about a couple of the books you wrote because they're kind of interesting. I'll take the children's book first because I think you were so clever in having a theme about how different people should be able to get along, but we do it through a dog named Max.
Right. Max, the Shih Tzu cockapoo-poo. He was one part Shih Tzu, two part Cocker Spaniel, and one part poodle, Shih Tzu cockapoo-poo.
And we can say that on the air.
Yeah, and the kids love that title, as you can imagine. They're in the middle of toilet training, probably.
Yes, but it's got a lovely theme, really does.
The story is about, you know, mixed breed, you know, all those different types of dogs all into, and that's how people should be. You know, we have a country of that, of people in all different mixtures, you know? And I would hope that people should come to New York. In this city of New York, we have that everywhere, and everybody gets along.
It's true. You wrote a book, Joy Shtick.
That was kind of a sort of a autobiographical about some of the things I've done, yeah.
Yeah, and it also had some of your stand-up material in it, didn't it?
Right.
Yeah, those are lovely books, and they're available on Amazon.
They still there? Oh, they are, really?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. So that's kind of nice.
And then there's a political book I wrote called The Great Gas Bag. You can figure that one out for yourself.
And the first name was not Jay.
No.
Well, you know, you did some show where I think it turned out that of all the kind of combinations of singles and married, the married men were the most happy. Was that true?
Oh, yeah. That was something I read, that married men are the happiest.
Yes.
I think it was single women might have been even happier than married men. The most unhappy were single men and married women.
Well, the reason I asked about the married men, it's a strange thing to read or hear because half marriages we know end in divorce. So
I know.
I guess it's the other half that are happy. I don't know.
I think that they end in divorce doesn't mean that the man doesn't go for another woman and get married again.
It's true. It's true.
But you can think a poor lonely guy all by himself, it's hard for them. They don't have the interaction that women have.
Well, that's true. That is true. And also, most guys, if they leave their wife, they leave for somebody.
Usually.
Women will leave because they had enough.
But guys, they're not
going unless there's
always another woman involved. In most cases, I've never heard of a marriage where the guy left on because he got bored or he got tired. There's always someone waiting in the wings.
There is. It's very rare that they just go out on their own. Tell me, in doing these stand-up gigs, which you don't do anymore, but when you did do them, What was the high of those? A great audience? When did you? That was it, I guess. Huh?
That's it. Yeah. When you knew that when that audience is there for you, it's true on The View also. Some days I go out there and the audiences are tired or whatever, and it's okay, the show, because I have other people around me. But when you're doing stand-up, like I always say, I'm naked and you have clothes on. And if you people with your clothes on are not going to be responsive to what I'm doing, it makes it 10 times harder for me. And, you know, you have to do your time whether they like you or not. So when you have a crowd that, like, laughs at everything, you just, it's a real high. It's better than any marijuana or any martini. Especially when you're on a roll and you get into that state, that fugue state, you know, and then they keep coming and they keep coming and you're ad-libbing and you're playing. It's the best. But if it's not that, it's very hard to do.
I also love, especially so many of my friends are performers, I also love the high afterwards that you're on or they're on. It's a great high because it kind of keeps going even after the audience has left. They're still swinging from it. And that's nice. That's nice.
And that's why you need a glass of wine to sort of level you off.
Come down a bit, yeah. What was the best advice or some of the best advice you've ever gotten from anybody in show business or out of show business? Do you remember?
Want to hear the bad advice?
Sure. Bad advice is even more exciting.
I was told to sing in my act. No. And then... And I was told to change my voice by an acting teacher.
Really?
I said, I can't. I don't know how to do that. How am I going to change my voice?
Yeah. Well, two of our greatest actors did. F. Murray Abraham and Frank Langella. Both of them. F. Murray was a Tex-Mex guy, grew up in El Paso, could speak Spanish, but he got the John Barrymore records and the John Gielgud records and made his voice. As did Frank Langella. So you can do it, but those are 2 out of 4 million, aren't too many.
They had tremendous motivation. I can see changing your accent, but your actual voice, that really requires a lot of work.
Yes, well, they did it. As far as we had talked about highs earlier in the show, but I'm interested in, because we're going to wind this up now.
Okay.
I bet you're happy to hear. I'm wondering if when you look back at the career, what were a couple of the real highs that you had?
Besides these moments on stage, you mean?
Well, it could be I'm making it up, Catch a Rising Star, Midnight on January 8th. I mean, I don't know, but...
New Year's Eve is always a tough night, by the way. A lot of drunks. People are like, it's difficult New Year's Eve. Everybody starts drinking early on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
But highs that, let's say, Steve, can you remember anything? I have to ask my husband. Oh, yeah. Certain people that I've met over the years. You know, that's right. He's good at this. He remembers stuff I can't. I have so many things in my head all the time. So meeting Catherine Deneuve, which was one of my idols. I've always been an incredible fan of hers. I always say if I was a lesbian, she's my type.
Well, you must have loved Belle de Jour.
I did love Belle de Jour. I've seen all her movies.
Yeah.
And also meeting Mel Brooks and Sid Caesar one time at an event and hanging out with them. And also interviewing Mel Brooks on one of my shows and Carl Reiner. These are like my idols from when I was in high school, you know? And
yes.
To actually be with them was such a kick. I can't even tell you. And the other person was Robert Klein, who was my role model. Now, Robert is not that much older than me, but I was not doing comedy when he was. And I used to see him on this Ed Sullivan show, and I thought, I want to be like that. He's a teacher. I was a teacher. He talks about real things, real life. He doesn't look crazy. He looks normal, like me. And he was my role model. And just this week, I asked him if he would be in one of my plays. I have a part for him. And he said that he's retired, that he basically is reading to his grandchildren at this point. But he said to me in the email, there was a thing I used to do in my act about how everyone thinks I'm Jewish. I don't know why, but maybe the name, I don't know, the accent, I don't know what it was. But you couldn't. And I said... And a few years ago, I get a call. Happy Hanukkah. I said, Ma, I'm not Jewish.
Well, the truth is, I always thought you were Jewish. I did.
Everyone does. So Robert Klein writes to me yesterday and quotes me that line and said, one of your best. And I was like, that's a thrill for me, that Robert Klein, my idol that I've been revered my whole career, remembers a piece of my material. Come
there
on.
There you go. There you go.
Being in this business, you know?
Now, we won't talk about who the actor or actress is, but in one of your plays or any of your plays, have you ever been sitting there thinking, this person's killing my play? Killing my play.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah. And
Here's what I know about actors. You can be a brilliant actor, but if you don't have that comedy gene, you can't do my stuff or other comedies. It's very easy for a dramatic actor, a comedic actor to do drama. The other way around is harder. A dramatic actor has trouble doing comedy. There's something, as somebody said, I can't remember who, I can never remember anybody, said you need to have a circus going on inside you to do comedy.
Well, it's true.
It's like a certain choice that you make that makes it funny.
I was trying to hire, and I thought I had hired years ago, Burt Reynolds to do a comedy by Larry Gelbart. Yeah. And what he said to me was, I understand his rhythm.
Very good.
I think that's what you're talking.
Burt Reynolds was a very funny guy, yeah.
But I think that's what you're talking about, the rhythm. No.
It's not just rhythm, Julian. It's also the choice of how to say the thing or where you're coming from, you know?
Yeah, and that you can't teach anyone. They either have it or they don't. That's one of the reasons when people say, well, to me, don't you feel bad making someone come back more than once or twice for a role? I say no, because we could make a mistake and you can hit. I've had an actor hit lightning in a bottle, came in fantastic. I was working with Arthur Penn, who was the director. I said, Arthur, we finally found him. He said, nope, not yet. I said, what do you mean? He was great. He said, yeah, he was great today. We'll bring him back next week. And we brought him back next week and he wasn't.
Well, maybe you should have given him a third shot, but maybe the second time he had something on his mind.
It could be, but Arthur moved on, and I jumped with him. I mean, that was it.
I was in junior high school. I auditioned for the High School of Performing Arts. Did I tell you this story already?
You did, and I loved it, especially the group, and then you get this sourpuss.
Right. What you're telling me about this actor, I relate to that. And the only reason I couldn't do it the second time was I was, like, scared because it was unfamiliar. Maybe that happened to your actor.
Well, but in your case, you had an audience the first time and only one sourpuss. Yeah. We had the same two of us. We were there. There was no change.
That's true. But if I had to do that over again, I could do it because I have technique now. You need technique.
Yes, that's right. Well, and also we established earlier that you learned rejection early. And that's one of the toughest things about the business we're in.
I feel terrible. Sorry for the kids, young children, child actors. I don't know how. I mean, I was reading somewhere that Margaret O'Brien, her mother would tear butterflies in front of her so that she would make the kid cry.
Yes.
I mean, I know. Who would put their child through something like that?
A stage door mother, apparently, you know. Yeah. But it is true. I mean, I've found over the years that working with wonderful actors, some of them are so damaged by what happened before they became a star that it's very hard for them to get past being damaged goods. It just is. And so I always used to say, they're guilty, like in court, like in traffic court, they're guilty with an explanation. I understand what they went through. I wish they wouldn't do it with me.
Yeah, but you got to get past that. You can't keep.
Well, you do.
What's the point of being successful if you can't have fun with the success?
Well, that's right. That's true. But I'm afraid that doesn't necessarily work that way. Anyhow, occasionally, only once or twice I had to fire someone. It was always tough for me to do because not what I wanted to do to begin with.
I haven't been able to fire. I can't even fire a housekeeper. I'd rather have a dirty house than have to fire a housekeeper.
Okay, I'll accept that. But I bet you it would be hard if it was a lead in one of your plays. You'd find the nerve.
No, the producer does that. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, all right. That's okay. That's true. But you got, that's right. I'll take that responsibility. But you have to go and say, hey, get rid of them.
Well, you can see it in their performance. It's yeah. like a the thing I like about writing for theater is that it's like it takes a village, and you're not the only one there, and the fun of it is being with other people. And the downside is when somebody has to go, and you don't have to be the one to do it.
Yeah, and I had mentioned to you earlier about Neil, for example, Neil Simon. You yeah. couldn't change anything. You could not change anything. But right. you're not that way. You don't feel that way, do you?
No. In fact, my monologues, I break the. I'm in them. Like I'll be in the one this weekend in Jersey, and I break the fourth wall all the time because I've had 35 years of stand-up material where you know experience where I talk to the audience and I do it easily. And at one point, Judy Gold, the very funny comedian Judy Gold.
I know who she is.
She was doing one of my monologues, and I'm sitting behind her waiting to go on. You know, we're all on the stage at the same time. And she and I were doing shtick back and forth, and it's fun, you
yes.
know?
Yeah. So,
yeah, and I don't mind if she would go off of it. Some people can do it. Some people don't know how to do it, and they're very strict. Mostly legit actors do not do it.
No. And if you think they don't, you should see with the English actors, they don't want to improvise yeah. at all. They've been taught at RADA.
Even when they're doing comedy?
Well, and comedy, they're a little looser, but still tight, very tight. Did you ever want to quit as a stand-up? Did you ever say, you know, I had enough? This is really
I've
tough.
Told you I quit. I'm not doing it now.
No, but I'm talking about you did for 30 some odd years. Yeah. I'm saying.
Oh, you mean when I was doing.
Yeah, when you were young and doing.
I don't know if I'm repeating myself with this interview because I can't remember what I said before, but I'd get in the car with my husband or somebody and I said, "This is the last time I'm doing this." Every single time.
Yes.
So yeah. Then I would do it.
Anyhow, I want to thank you not only for this interview but for our times. At Lee Grant's, or any time we've spent time together. Yeah. I think you're quite a gal. I really do.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.